Hello everyone, and welcome to a new episode of The Geopolitical Pickle. I'm your host, Juanfri, and I'm joined as always by my colleague, Ronan Wordsworth. How are you doing, Ronan?
Very well, thanks, Juanfri. What about yourself?
Well, it's been a while. I'm enjoying a little bit this early summer that we're having here in Prague, so it's always nice.
It's always nice. It is nice to hear.
It's been a while since we recorded our last episode and published our last episode. We've had to do certain things in our personal life. But now we're back, and we're back for good. We'll tell you a little bit later at the end of the episode about some project that we're going to be involved in the future so that you just pay attention to our media. And today, I think we can start. And we're going to start again by talking about something that we've already talked before, which is the Sahel, which is Africa, which is the...
Yeah, well, exactly. I think we'd start today by touching on Niger and how that has evolved since the original episode we did on them aired last year, and the changing dynamics in Niger, and then regionally what's playing out at the moment across the Sahel region. So obviously we have the G5 Sahel countries, with a lot of them have turned towards Russia, and we'll go into more detail about that later. But
yeah, just a little recap. Niger's government was ousted in a military coup in July 2023. This was the last addition to the series of military takeovers that spawned throughout the Sahel and West Africa and joining the so-called Belt of Coup. This name was given to refer to those states that saw successful military coups happening between 2022 and 2023 and were characterized by a strong anti-French sentiment, anti-Western sentiment, and pro-Russian stance. As Ronan just said, if you want to know more about the Belt of Coups, you can check our episode on the topic What's Driving the Coup in West Africa, and you will have the link in the description. Ronan has actually been writing a little bit about this, and me myself have also been researching, but today I'm going to be asking more Ronan because he's been more knowledgeable about it. So let me ask you from the beginning, Ronan, it's been almost a year after the coup in Niger. The military junta has ordered the U.S. troops in the country to exit. What capacities has the U.S. had in Niger these previous years, and what have they been used for?
So if we look back, Niger was actually the largest American base in Africa, including, I think it's called Air Base 201, which is in Agadez, the second biggest city, I believe, in the country. They also had a large troop presence at Air Base 101, which is in the capital, Niamey. And that area there is now being occupied as well with Russian troops. I think that came out of the news a few weeks ago that Russian troops have basically moved into Air Base 101.
At the same time that the Americans were still there.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And so the main base, which is in Agadez, I'll talk about that one more because that's a more important base. The U.S. spent over $100 million developing that base. It's where they do a lot of their drone operations, monitoring Islamic violent extremist groups across the Sahel, because obviously the area of the Sahel, there is vast open desert areas, so there's lots of places for these terrorist groups to actually hide, and they do that very effectively in these ungoverned areas. And so a lot of these counterterrorism operations happens by the usage of this drone base. Now, in addition to that, they said there was some over 1,100 troops, I believe, American troops in Niger. Following the coup, the U.S. was kind of pragmatic towards their approach with the military junta. They were very slow to actually call it a coup. Part of the reason for that, I believe, was to be able to try and negotiate to hold on to these bases and not disrupt the operations in the counter-terrorist sphere, which has been ongoing for the last 10 years, basically with European missions, with UN missions, and they provide assistance to that. So that was how they responded then, and now we've seen this shift in the approach of the military government in the capital, in Niamey, and actually now said that they want the US troops out of the country, and the US has said that they will comply with that. But this is a big change for them. They have to now find a new home for as a reliable partner to be able to continue these operations from.
Where does this base in Agadez stand for the United States? Because as far as I understand, the AFRICOM, the African Command of the United States, is based in in Germany. It's not even based in Africa. But Agadez, as far as I understand, was the largest drone base in the whole of Africa, no? So like most of the counter-terrorist operations and stuff like this should have been, the center of command would have been Agadez, or?
Correct, yeah. So all the drone operations were run from there. So as it was vital for their operations, not just in Niger, but also in the surrounding regions, which have also had their share of violent extremist terrorist attacks. If we look, Burkina Faso is now the number one most terrorized country in the world as of 2023, overtaking Afghanistan. All these operations were basically run out of Agadez, the base there. And what's also important, actually, if you look where Agadez is in the map, it's like right in the center of Niger. This was a very popular route for smuggling both illicit goods, people trafficking, everything in towards Europe from Western Africa up through the town and through Agadez, basically, and then into Libya and then into Europe from there, or from Tunisia. But yeah, I think it's a very strategic location there to be able to operate the basically operations across the whole Sahel region.
That's really interesting. And how has the USA taken this decision? How has, because I mean, for example, if we see the example of France in Mali or Burkina, clearly the French didn't take it really nicely. But the United States, as you said, they had took a more pragmatic approach towards the junta. So how have they taken this decision? I mean,
yeah, I think there was a lot of disappointment from Pentagon. Like if you look at the spokespeople there, I believe what changed was maybe potentially more pressure from the Pentagon to stop this collaboration between the Russian military forces and the Niger military rulers. And there was also reports that actually they were turning towards Tehran and speaking with Iran about providing them with uranium, which is obviously a big...
Do they have nuclear facilities, or
they've got lots of them too. Niger has like significant uranium reserves, which was being mined before, and there was reports that basically they were going to sell a lot of this to Iran.
I got it the opposite way.
So I think then obviously that becomes a bit of a red line for the US, and I think this is what prompted them to finally actually speak up to the government there, and which is eventually caused this rift that's now basically become irreparable, I would say. As long as the military is in charge, I can't see how the US could possibly return to working with the Niger government.
And what will they do? Because I assume that base was important, not just for security in Niger, as you were saying, but for the region. And the United States still has a presence in the region with within other countries, like allies and so on. What's the path forward for the US? Like, will they relocate? Nothing has been said yet as official, but I assume they will be trying to look for another place to stay, no?
Correct, yeah. So nothing official has come out, like you say, but there has been reports that they've been in discussions with a few countries, Ivory Coast being one, Benin, Togo, all those countries, as potentially being a site for a new base. Obviously, I think they're going through the different risk assessments as well. They don't want to then establish somewhere else and potentially then have the same situation happen again.
That would be terrible, to be fair.
Exactly. And so they definitely want to continue these counterterrorism operations, because the Sahel is now the number one hotbed for terrorism in the world. And that has the potential to, if it's unchecked, leave the region, start terrorizing the West African coastline countries, and then even potentially go into Europe again, like from the migration crisis. If we start to see that sort of issue with this like lack of security in Sahel, we could start seeing migration going into Europe, and then with that, the associated risks of terrorist attacks coming from this Sahel region. So I think it's going to remain definitely a strategic priority for the AFRICOM forces to be able to be there and help combat this, but... I would say like most likely for me is probably Ivory Coast. I think that's the one I've heard the most development.
Yeah.
In terms of,
it makes sense too. It's a larger country. It
can, yeah.
Like a little bit more stable at this point. It would be interesting. We could do an episode of history of coups in Africa since the 80s, and we would, like, probably no country would be without Czech. Okay, let's get a little bit into what was the motivation behind Niger's junta decision, because as you've mentioned, there's obviously, like, well, Russian troops of the newly absorbed by the Russian military Wagner group, like, after killing Prigozhin, Wagner is absorbed into the Russian military, and now they had some troops over there. And we've also seen in Niger's neighbors, in Mali and Burkina, how Russian troops have replaced certain aspects of the security, and, like, they've now engaged in combat alongside the country's forces. Was this the motivation? Is this the motivation behind Niger's junta decision? Or because I don't really understand if, like, the motivation is just to replace it with the Russians, or is it because some anti-Western sentiment as the other countries, for example?
I think, well, if we go into the anti-Western sentiment, a lot of that has been bred by the Russian propaganda machines which operate in these regions. Some of the complaints against, like, French neocolonialism are genuine, but also it's kind of gone into overdrive to make people very much think that Russia is a great ally to them. And I mean, I would say that couldn't be further from the truth. But if we look within the countries, the military leaders there, as you say, they now have very tight links with the old Wagner group. They're now part of the Africa Corps. And Russia's Africa Corps basically offers these military juntas protection for themselves and their positions as the leaders of the country, illegitimate, undemocratic leaders, by providing them security forces in exchange for access to mineral wealth extraction kind of thing. And so it's attractive to the military leaders there. They have then very little risk to themselves of being deposed, and they do not seem to care at all about the rest of the people in the country, because if we look, the statistics are very clear that in all three, Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger, the countries that turned away from the West and kicked out Western-led operations and have gone towards Russia, in all three, the security situation has deteriorated horrifically. There's been many accounts of massacres of civilians. So if we look, even just in February, there was, I think, 230 civilians killed in Burkina Faso, 90 in Mali. They found other mass graves. And then the military response, like, and all of these are reportedly done by the military and Wagner forces against the population, because they accuse them of harboring terrorists and stuff within the community, and they just indiscriminately kill the whole village. So I think it seems pretty cut and dry. Russia offer a service, and unfortunately, it's the average person really suffers, but you can see why it's attractive then to these military leaders to go towards Russia, because they don't really care about their human rights record or anything like that. It's just purely...
There's also not really a promotion of, like, what does the because, I mean, someone can say, okay, the Russians are going to get other resources. We'll talk a little bit about the resources in Niger. But someone could also say, okay, so, like, the French also were providing security in some aspect, but, like, their company were extracting resources also from these countries. What would be the difference in, like, what the French, or, I mean, the US, it's not like they had, like, a proper counter-terrorist operation going on there. They were supporting national governments in their in their efforts. But, for example, France did develop this Operation Barkhane, stuff like this, push for G5 Sahel. What would be the difference in the approach? What examples do we have of Russia getting into this situation before?
So I think when we look at what, say, France's operations in there, the military operations are generally done with the national governments, and a lot of training and resources spent on, like, equipping and training the government troops to be able to better combat the different armed force groups. Whereas the commercial side has been a lot of French companies operating within these countries. They probably do definitely have a good deal, but they still do invest money back into the country. Whereas Russia is more on the model of extraction and then just take it out of the country. So I think there is quite a big difference there. I think there's a really good report I recommend people to listen to. It's called the Blood Gold Report. I can't remember who wrote it, but it's a very thorough investigation into Russian activities across Africa and tracks the amount that they've actually been able to extract. I think it's actually over in the billions of dollars worth of minerals, particularly gold, but then also other precious minerals per year that they're actually taking out of the country. So yeah, you can see it's very profitable for Russia. I think they do operate very differently to the other companies. Like if we look, even as Australian mining companies operate in Mali still, but yeah, they're more commercial entities and they operate with the licenses granted by the government. And then so obviously they pay taxes, some of the money goes back to the government, whereas the Russian activities are kind of all illicit, all
beer at
the table. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And like then let's talk a little bit about why Niger would be interesting. Although I think in this sense we cannot really talk about Niger as a unique entity. We need to see Niger in the geopolitical reality of the Sahel. But particularly in Niger, what importance does it have? You've mentioned uranium, gold. As far as it's understood, Wagner Group prior to being absorbed had got the lease for a gold mine in Niger, but at the same time it's a landlocked country in the Sahel, which is an arguably really poor region, if not the poorest. What geopolitical importance may have for Russia to establish itself there?
If we look at kind of the wider Russian strategy in Africa, it's definitely been to try and turn countries against the West. I think they see it as kind of a little bit of a hark back to the Cold War geopolitics era,
mm-hmm.
where they're basically saying we want to have a block of countries that we're allied with against the West. And they've been made a lot of grounds, I would say, across Africa. So as you said, Niger is one, but then we look at the map, Mali, Burkina Faso, obviously the three of them collectively have now formed the Alliance of Sahel States, all supported by Russian security forces. Then there's Central African Republic, which the government there is also basically protected by Russian mercenaries.
Mm-hmm.
In Libya, so southern Libya, southern and eastern Libya, where General Haftar's forces are, that was also supported heavily by Russian troops, Wagner troops, and that's like all oil fields and things like that in that region of Libya. Sudan, which is obviously still has its own civil war going on right now, Russian forces were there as well, supporting the RSF, the Rapid Support Forces, who are currently fighting the government forces. So
one day we need to make an episode of Sudan, but it's so...
Exactly. I mean, it doesn't get much attention either.
Yeah.
It's been going on for now over a year, the civil war there in Sudan.
There's millions displaced at this point.
And it's also, yeah, very complex as well. But again, Russians are there in the gold mines there. And now they've sort of got this like collective group of allied countries. And then the last one was Chad, which they just had their elections, but by almost all accounts that were not really observed as democratic. And just interestingly, the US troops also left Chad just ahead of the election. I think this was partially Chad requested them to leave. I have the feeling that they'll probably come back after. I think this was some posturing by Deby, the incumbent political leader who basically came to power in a coup when his father was killed. He wanted to be seen as not being anti-West, so he kicked out I think it was only about 80 American Special Forces troops. They're still, Chad is still very much closely aligned with France, but they also have shifted now where they're also becoming a close ally of Russia as well, which kind of completes this belt. Yeah. Yeah. So they sort of complete this belt now of Russian aligned countries all the way across there. And it makes it logistically easier to basically keep extracting it and then also to be able to export them from there as well. So, look, yeah, it's been a long-term strategy, I think, for Russia to try and turn a lot of these countries. They are all landlocked, basically, at the moment, as you say, but maybe not into Libya. That's the access point out, which, again, would go through Niger. So that's why it's kind of a vital partner for them. It's sort of their grander strategy, I would think.
So why would Russia... apart from the fact of having them connected and taking them out of the different sphere of influence, what does Russia win from convincing these juntas, or from having these juntas sided with them? Like, Russia is a country with a lot of resources on its own. But is it more in like countering French or Western influence in Africa, so that then they can have, I don't know, more of a say in the decisions that are taken in the African continent? Is it all seen in the framework of the invasion to Ukraine? How? What do we think Russia tries to aim here? Because, I mean, these countries are really far from from Russia, and it's not like they have an economic capacity to make Russia be a game changer.
No, but I think there is a few major forces at play for Russia. I think firstly, obviously, they do get a lot of money out of these gold sales. I know they do lots of ebony wood from Central African Republic, for instance, which is like very, very valuable wood.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of different trades going on there. So it's not insignificant amounts of money. As you said, it's not going to change the world for them, but it's still significant amounts of funding that also helps them then evade some of the sanctions that have been put on them by Western countries. And then additionally, I think it's their way of saying, like, they're trying to get it into this block mentality and say, like, we've got all these countries supporting us against our war against NATO, basically, as they call the Russia invasion into Ukraine. They say we're fighting against NATO, and they want to have these aligned countries to say, like, we don't like the West. We want to support Russia's led efforts, and they're fighting a just war and things like this. So it comes with some sort of political capital, some sort of release, maybe a political pressure in forums such as the UN, where traditionally, say, the US would have a very good position to be able to pressure a lot of these African states to vote against Russia in any potential resolutions. And we've seen actually that a lot of these African countries that have now become allied with Russia have not condemned and chosen to go against a lot of the UN resolutions.
During the resolutions, like on Ukraine.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
That is actually pretty interesting, because what I wonder, obviously there's got to be some anti-French sentiment stemming just from the fact of being a former French colony and stuff that we mentioned in the previous episode, but obviously there is also known to be many disinformation campaigns taking place in the States, which in my opinion, like, it's more like getting a good image of Russia than getting a bad image of France. Like, that bad image of France could already be there, but it's giving a good image of Russia, which, like, if you look at the results that they've had anywhere else, like, for example, it's known that Russians were taking, like, or Wagner was taking care of the president of Venezuela for some time. Like, it's not like the country went any better.
Mm-hmm.
Central African Republic, it's not like the country went any better. But yeah, it is interesting. It's interesting to learn about that, and we'll actually talk about it, about that disinformation, shortly. I want to go a little bit into the region, because I think you've covered a lot. Thank you very much. But I would like to go a little bit in the region. When the coup started happening, Nigeria through ECOWAS said that they were going to invade. If I'm correctly, it was Burkina Faso. It was Niger. But then that invasion didn't take place. Reasons were taken into account, and reasons were given, but I don't know if you would agree with me that it was like a loud bark with actually nothing much behind.
Yeah.
Like, Nigeria cannot really exert power within its own borders in many, many areas, and they will have to cross those already dangerous areas that they have in the north to enter these countries. Plus, it's an expenditure, it's soldiers that you're putting, blah, blah. So, ECOWAS was against these coups. They threatened with an invasion. That invasion didn't happen. What is currently the relation of Niger with its neighbors? Obviously, good with Mali and Burkina.
With the rest, I would say it's deteriorated significantly. So, as you said, Nigeria was the current head of the ECOWAS, and that was President Tinubu, and I 100% agree. I think they were all all bark and no bite, proved that they don't have any sort of strength of as an institution, I think, to be able to act against their members when they did say this. But the relationship between ECOWAS and those three countries in particular has basically been severed completely. I think the three of them in February this year actually said that they wanted to leave ECOWAS effective immediately, which is not really how it's supposed to work. It's supposed to be a one-year transition period, but it's very difficult to actually see how that would be enforced anyway. And then they've made their own defensive alliance of the Sahel states, they call themselves. In response, we see ECOWAS now, in the last week or two, they've been talking about potentially putting together a counterterrorism standby fighting force. I struggle to see how this would be funded. They said they need $2.6 billion to fund it. $1 billion, they said, will come from ECOWAS countries' contributions, but I think that's ambitious. And
$1 billion.
Yeah, that's it, exactly. Like, as you said, a lot of these are not rich countries, unless Nigeria does a lot of the heavy lifting of that money, but they've got a lot of internal problems themselves. So I don't see how necessarily that will work, but I think they also see the or have this fear of spreading insecurity from these three Sahel states,
which has already been taking place, no? And it was already been taking place around the Chad region, around the Lake Chad in
Lake Chad base,
Syria,
exactly,
and all these areas. It's already getting worse.
And like, say, for instance, just over the last few weeks as well, we've seen more issue between Mauritania and Mali as the Malian troops supported by Wagner have come into the Mauritanian territory, reportedly killed 15 civilians or 13 civilians in a border village there on the Mauritanian side while apparently chasing terrorists. And in response, now Mauritania has conducted some large-scale military exercises along the Malian border. So Mauritania was part of the G5 Sahel as well, which this joint grouping with Mali, Burkina Faso, Chad and Niger was set up to counter these terrorist insurgencies that were sweeping across the Sahel. It had its problems, but I would say largely it did help to reduce the number of attacks. And now with those three countries leaving, it spiked up again. Mauritania doesn't have any problem at the moment with terrorist attacks. The last one was before 2014 even. So I think they now see this risk because of the activities of their neighbors.
A country with a little population, or most of it concentrating in Nouakchott, like it's a lot of empty land in the end. I was actually going to ask you, is it finding interesting, but like in a town in the middle of the Sahara Desert, like you really need a satellite to tell you this is in Mauritania, this is in Mali, no? Because it's like
a fence or something.
A fence or something.
But that's what now I think Mauritanian troops are going to be patrolling along the border more often to try and prevent incursions from Malian troops into the territory. And Mauritania has emerged as probably the EU's preferred partner now for the region.
Yep.
We see like the Mauritanian government has a lot of training exercise led by NATO troops. The EU's investing a lot of money there as well in terms of developing energy projects. There's green hydrogen projects, which are all focused around Mauritania, because it's a closeness to Europe in general and its stability and its the fact that it is still staying a strong Western ally as opposed to the other countries that were part of the G5 Sahel. So I think that's one dynamic. We see even in Benin, right, they have the border with Niger as well, I believe, and they have cut off the oil pipelines. So Niger's oil exports were supposed to go through Benin out to sea, but they've shut down the border crossing there due to there's disagreements again about like these areas around the borders becoming more unstable in Niger, which then has the potential to spread out to a lot of these other West African countries, which don't have the military juntas leading them, but they have this fear potential flow-on effects.
Yeah.
Because of the surging instability in those other countries in their neighborhood.
Okay, so just to finish a little bit, I would like to ask you, and the last question would be, we've seen that the junta in Mali and the junta in Burkina Faso was really vocal against France, against the West in general, blah, blah, blah. looking to join together. They've actually joined in many ways. Also now Niger has entered in that sense, but I haven't really spotted that much of, or that level of belligerency in the discourse from Nigerian leaders. Is it because I haven't encountered it, or there hasn't been that much? It's been a little bit more of a pragmatic, although taking the same position, but more of a pragmatic approach.
Yeah, I think there definitely exists as well that anti-French rhetoric, anti-Western narrative, especially. It's actually become much more pronounced in the last few months, I would say. Originally, when they came to power, they also were saying the same things about being anti-French. They shut down the French mining operations there, revoked their licenses, and expelled the French mining and stuff like that. So I think it definitely exists the same way. What's interesting is, like, in the neighborhood, you've got Chad right next door, which is still very close ally of France. They just had elections, and I think this is probably likely to happen in some of these other Alliance of Sahel States countries, that they'll have, like, I would call them fraudulent or phony elections, where just to legitimize their position as the leader of the country. And
yeah, like the latest Russian elections. No?
Exactly. So I
never thought was going to win.
And then the West has been condemning them, but and then that sort of feeds into this narrative of they're pushing anti-West agenda or whatever. So I think it will continue. And I don't know, like, these countries are now basically made their separation from the West Africa, and I think Russia will definitely continue to work on other countries to try and win them over as well, which I guess we'll touch on now, I guess, about the upcoming project we're going to have as well. So
yes, do you want to make the announcement? I was going to make it.
Because I think it works well here. What we have coming up, probably over the summer, I think in July, we'll be having a mini-series on Russian disinformation and then Russian disinformation across
it's
Africa.
The Disinformation Project.
And we're lucky enough to have this to be co-sponsored by NATO, to produce this five-part series. So we're going to try and get some really good speakers on there, professionals in disinformation, then some other specialists in specifically the Russian operations across Africa, and go, like, really deep into the different ways that it's used. I mean, Russia, the experts at this disinformation, misinformation, and propaganda, they do it again in their own side, their own territories, and now they've exported that across Africa and really try and go into the details. And I think that will also have the benefit of people becoming more aware of how it works, how it operates. And
yes, it would be not just about the political part of it, or like the factual part of it, but also, like, how does this information work? How do these campaigns work? How to spot them? And yeah, the project would be co-sponsored. So yeah,
co-sponsored
by NATO and by Charles University in Prague. And we will be bringing you more news as we have them. And we hope you like it, and we hope you'll have it. Hopefully, it will be with good video quality. We will make some nice videos. We can try and make some graphics. We'll see. Don't ask us too much. We're editing capacities. But yeah, stay tuned, because that's going to be interesting. And I think we can finish this today. Thank you very much, Rona. Thank you very much for all this explanation. It was really nice.
Thank you to you guys for listening at home. And we'll catch you next time on the Geopolitical Pickle.
Ciao, ciao.
The Geopolitical Pickle is created by Ronan Wordsworth and Juan Francisco Muñoz. Follow us on Instagram at The Geopolitical Pickle or Twitter at The Geopickle for more content, and follow us on every podcast platform.